I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Halliburton, the company that came under fire for its no-bid contract to put out oil fires in Iraq, is now being questioned again. Congressman Henry Waxman, a California Democrat, says that new documents show the up to $7 billion contract is more lucrative than previously disclosed, allowing Halliburton to pump and distribute oil as well. The Houston-based energy company, which was run by current Vice President Dick Cheney from 1995 to 2000, says the terms of the contract always included the operation of facilities and distribution of products. Well, joining us on the line is David Ivanovich. He's a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. He's based in Washington, D.C. And David, good morning, first of all.
Good afternoon.
Well, Congressman Waxman has had an exchange of letters with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. What's happened in that exchange?
Well, they've been battling back and forth for several weeks now. It's really been a battle over transparency, how open the Army Corps of Engineers is going to be about the Halliburton contract.
Well, he says it was disclosed for the first time in a letter that he got that Halliburton would, you know, essentially pump and distribute products.
Well, Lieutenant General Robert Flowers of the Army Corps of Engineers sent a letter to Congressman Waxman last week trying to explain the scope of the Halliburton contract, and in that mentioned the terms operation of facilities and distribution of products. Congressman Waxman has then interpreted that language a little bit, I believe, and suggests that it means operation of Iraqi oil fields and distribution of Iraqi oil.
Well, what's your sense of what it means?
Well, it's a little opaque. I was in southern Iraq last week, and what Halliburton subsidiary KBR is really doing over there is they're repairing a pipeline that had ruptured during because of some of the fighting during the war. They're trying to get some oil gas separation facilities up and running again. They're basically trying to repair the infrastructure so that the oil fields can be operated. But the whole idea, I believe, is to have the Iraqi oil workers who work for something called the Southern Oil Company to actually produce the oil.
And in a statement that Halliburton released, they said this was an announcement of the contract in March. That statement says that following capping of the oil fires, their company will perform emergency repair as directed to provide for the continuity of operations of the Iraqi oil infrastructure. They say that's what was in the original release. So critics are saying that it didn't go as far, perhaps, as the recent exchange of letter has. But just quickly in the minute we have, David, Halliburton, as you write, has a record of cost overruns, charging $85 for a piece of plywood, for instance, that should have cost $14. And this tied with the fact that the company is tied to Mr. Cheney, who received $33 million in stocks when he left and still gets about $180,000 a year in deferred compensation. Doesn't this add to a perception problem that the company has, especially with the Iraqis?
Well, I think it does, yes. I think that's the risk you take when you hire someone from government like Halliburton did, and hiring who was then Defense Secretary Cheney, or after he had left office with the first Bush administration. And then when Mr. Cheney left to join the current president's ticket, Halliburton was just open to attacks from all sides, being accused of undue influence at the White House.
And very briefly, there will be public bids for these jobs when?
Well, the idea is to have the first competitive bid given out by the end of August, although the Army Corps of Engineers has said that that date could slip.
Well, David, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
David Ivanovich is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
The Bush administration has removed the possibility of wilderness protection for more than 200 million acres of public land in the American West, an historic shift in the federal government's approach to land management that came without any formal announcement, late on a Friday night a few weeks ago, just before Congress adjourned. Interior Secretary Gail Norton decided to no longer consider 2.6 million acres in Utah as possible wilderness, though former Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt had in effect so designated the land. Critics say that, in effect, removes the wilderness protection from all other public land. Assistant Interior Secretary for Policy Management and Budget Lynn Scarlett says the move was simply bureaucratic.
The previous administration tried to continue to use what was a time-limited process. Now, what we have done is to say, look, that process you used really was over, and in fact, you know, we just read the law and it just says time's up.
Well, joining us on the line now is John Andrews. He's Associate Director of State Lands in Utah. Welcome, Mr. Andrews.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Andrews, how much more vulnerable now, in your opinion, is public land to losing the protection of being designated as wilderness?
I think this is very unlikely to have much of an on-the-ground impact. This really brings these lands back to the status quo that was prevailing prior to 2001 or 1999 in Utah, and really does not have a lot of on-the-ground impact. There will still be the ability of the federal agencies to manage the lands protectively in accordance with the land use planning process. So I really don't believe that there will be a lot of on-the-ground impact.
Interior Secretary Gail Norton decided to no longer extend reviews of land for possible wilderness designation. Isn't that a change?
What this decision does, and I think I would go back to your introduction, which said that this removed the possibility of these lands being considered for wilderness, that simply isn't true. What this decision will do will be to leave the decision on wilderness to Congress, which is where the law says it should be. So this doesn't remove the possibility of the lands being considered for wilderness.
Yeah.
I think it's also pretty important to note that this doesn't impact all the lands that are currently formally designated for wilderness study. We have well over 3 million acres of land in Utah that is formally protected as wilderness study. It's not wilderness, but it is set aside. And those lands won't be affected at all.
Well, why the widespread perception now, then, in many editorials, for example, in the New York Times, for example, saying public land is now more vulnerable to losing wilderness designation? Is this just a misreading of what the Interior Secretary did in the minute or so we have left?
Yes, I believe that that's absolutely correct, that it is something that makes a great soundbite for the environmental community. But in fact, the lands can be designated as wilderness should Congress so decide.
John Andrews, we want to thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
We were joined by John Andrews. He's Associate Director of State Lands in Utah.
Well, while we're on the subject of wilderness preservation, here's a quick quiz. Name an organization that has logged forests, drilled for natural gas under the last breeding ground of an endangered bird species, and helped pave the way for comedian David Letterman to buy a Martha's Vineyard mansion on rare open sand plains. The organization is the Nature Conservancy, the 52-year-old nonprofit environmental group with $3 billion in assets that critics say is too often combining conservation with business. The Nature Conservancy's problems are currently being spotlighted in a series in the Washington Post, and we're joined on the line now by Post staff writer Joe Stevens. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Robin.
Well, there does seem to be a lot going on in this series about the Conservancy, but tell us, how did the Conservancy start?
Well, the Conservancy started as a small handful of environmentalists in Washington. They latched on to the idea of buying and holding land to keep it from being developed, and it just mushroomed from there.
And they also took on a very non-confrontational style, which they say bought them some important relationships.
Yes. They take the stance that they should not be the groups going out picketing and such. They want to get along with everyone. The revenue yearly is much more than 10 times that of the Sierra Club, which people might be more familiar with.
Some have said that this has led to alliances and deals that may cost the group some of their credibility. Tell us, for instance, about the David Letterman house.
David Letterman, some of his business interests got control of an existing house. There was one existing house on the property. The Conservancy's explanation for this is that it preempted even denser development, that if they had not come along and struck this deal, there might be even more homes there.
Yeah.
Some people disagree.
What about the relationship that the Conservancy has with corporations?
On their governing board and on their advisory boards, they have the CEOs of a number of Fortune 500 companies, including some companies which have had some environmental issues in the past that have paid millions of dollars in fines for environmental problems.
And there seems to be a new commercialization of the Conservancy name that has disturbed many, for instance, licensing the name to products.
Right. And if you look around, you can now find the Nature Conservancy logo on neckties, on granola bars, breakfast cereal.
When, in fact, that, as one critic says in your article, a consumer might think that breakfast cereal was produced with some kind of sustainable agriculture, but it wasn't.
Exactly. Consumers Union has a real issue with the logo in that they think it might suggest, for example, that the product is organic, and when, in fact, in some cases, all it means is the company gave money to the Nature Conservancy.
Yeah. Stephen McCormick is president of the Conservancy. As you write, he received a huge signing bonus and also $1.5 million loan from the Conservancy with which he bought a mansion. But he's since changed that loan after your report?
Initially, once we found out about the loan and quizzed Conservancy officials about it, they told us the loan rate was 7%. That was not correct. It's more in the neighborhood of 4.6%. After we established that, Steve McCormick said that he would repay the loan and since has indeed done that.
Yeah. Well, in the end, is anything the Nature Conservancy is doing illegal?
Our series did not say that anything they had done is illegal. We talked to some tax lawyers, for example, who thought some of the tax arrangements which led to houses being built on formerly undeveloped land were questionable in, as far as their tax ramifications. Now, that generally was not the Conservancy. It'd be the individual taxpayer. And no one said it was illegal, but that in some cases, perhaps it was pushing the line on what's allowable as a tax deduction.
Hmm. What has the Nature Conservancy said in response to your series?
Well, they say they wish we had focused more on their successful projects. They've got 1,400 preserves around the world, and even their staunchest critics say that they've been able to keep a lot of land out of development.
Well, Joe, thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Stevens is staff writer for The Washington Post.
Don't forget, we always love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And for more information on the show, visit our website, here-now.org. Just ahead, an historical novel looks at the complex relationship between Adolf Hitler and his niece.
And later in the program, Boston is home of the bean and the cod, but one is endangered. We'll look at restrictions on cod fishing on Cape Cod and a total ban in Newfoundland, Canada. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
What if? A question history buffs and novelists love to hold up to the light of their imaginations to ponder. What if, for example, President Kennedy never went to Dallas? What if they'd printed perfectly easy-to-read ballots in West Palm Beach, Florida, in the 2000 election? And right up to the present, what if Saddam Hussein fell the first time around? Well, author Andy Nagorsky's debut historical novel, Last Stop Vienna, is full of what might have beens concerning Adolf Hitler. Now, we don't want to give away too much about the book and its surprising climax, but we can contemplate, as the book does, what if Hitler's obsessive relationship with his niece, Gelly, had not ended in her mysterious death. Andrew Nagorsky joins me on the line from the Carnegie Hall studio in New York City. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Bill. Great to talk to you.
You know, without redoing the history too much, the book is seen through the eyes of a young, uneducated, fiercely loyal follower of Hitler, who in the book eventually becomes very disillusioned with him. Remind us briefly how unlikely the rise of Hitler was.
Well, I think what people tend to look back at that period and say, all right, Germany was defeated at the end of World War II. It was a humiliating defeat. There was the chaos of the Weimar Republic, and somehow automatically in retrospect that seems to translate into Hitler's successful rise to power. But the more I studied that period, the more I went back and looked at the particulars, the more I became convinced that there was nothing inevitable about it, and there were any number of situations where Hitler almost didn't make it. I mean, the most graphic situation was the one which in effect got me thinking about a novel was the situation during the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923 when Hitler was just making his first grab for power. He was clearly unprepared, and he's marching down the street with his chief aide, and some shots ring out, and before you know it, his chief aide is lying dead. And you think about the fact, well, what if the trajectory of that bullet had been slightly different? How would that whole century have looked? So there were any number of things that would have been chance, but there were splits within the Nazi Party. There were tensions over Hitler's personality, over his relationship with his niece, as you mentioned earlier. Any number of things could have happened completely differently.
All vividly depicted in the book. But let's turn to the niece, Gelly. Actually, a story, for all that's been written and said about Adolf Hitler, that's not that really well known. Who was Gelly?
Well, Gelly was the daughter of Hitler's half-sister, Angela Raubel. She was almost 20 years younger than Hitler. So when she came to Munich, ostensibly as a medical student, and she was still a teenager, Hitler was already a man in his mid-30s. He was known for having these rather peculiar rallies, but he was also still a minor celebrity, but a celebrity nonetheless. And she enjoyed going around with her uncle. She soon began appearing with him in cafes and restaurants at the theater. And this, of course, began to prompt speculation. Well, what was their relationship? And as she became more and more seen as his escort, this created a great deal of speculation.
Were they lovers?
There was clearly a sexual side to their relationship. Whether they were conventional lovers is very much in dispute. But I offer in my book an account of what may have been the nature of that sexual relationship that is based on testimony of several people afterwards, including Otto Strasser, one of the characters in the book, one of the early members of the Nazi movement who later broke with Hitler and who was later debriefed by U.S. military intelligence during World War II, saying that there was a what we would call a twisted sexual relationship between them.
She died, Gelly did, from a bullet fired by Hitler's Walther 6.35 pistol. How much does that prove about who killed her, if anything?
It doesn't prove anything. It was officially ruled a suicide, but by all accounts, the report was put together very hastily under pressure from Hitler and his entourage. There are a couple things which convince many people it may not have been a suicide. It may have been murder. For one thing, Gelly was writing a letter which was found, appeared the letter of a perfectly normal young woman in very good spirits, talking about moving to Vienna, and breaks off in mid-sentence, and the next thing we know, she's dead with this bullet in her body. in Hitler's defense, people say, well, he in fact had gone off to a campaign rally up north, and his driver later recorded that he got a speeding ticket as they were coming back when they heard the news about Gelly. And Hitler was clearly upset with the news about Gelly. He would later put up a bust of Gelly in the chancellery when he came into power. But it's never been proven one way or another how she died, but a lot of people believe that one way or another Hitler was responsible.
Andy, what's the tricky part of writing an historical fiction? I guess in a way the story's there, but there must also be some fine lines to walk.
There are fine lines. I mean, what I tried to do in Last Stop Vienna is as much as possible create a world that was a real world as best as I could reconstruct it. Many of the characters are real. Of course, Hitler, Gelly, some of the top people in the Nazi Party. My fictional character is, of course, a work of the imagination. But I put him in real situations and try to see that whole period through his eyes and try to answer that question, why could someone get caught up in this movement? But what if history allows you to do is to walk those fine lines and then where there's only piecemeal evidence, create scenes, situations, how you think it may have developed, and then go beyond that and imagine a different twist, a different development, and a very different ending to the story than the one we knew that actually happened.
Those what-ifs. Andy Nagorski, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Bill.
Andrew Nagorski is a longtime Newsweek correspondent. He was based in Berlin in the mid-90s. His new book is Last Stop, Vienna, and we spoke to Andy from New York.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the unhealthy state of Medicaid. We explore various state budget cuts to health care for the poor and elderly and see how people are coping.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a new study finds that fish feel pain.
And some fishermen are hurting, too. Canada ends cod fishing, and Massachusetts fishermen may have to cut back on their hauls.
Well, in the case of both of the cod stocks, we've at least stabilized them. But in the long term, overfishing reduces the reproductive capacity of the stock to the point where the new babies coming in the population can't balance out what's being taken out by fishing.
These stories, and sticking to our theme, a visit to the International Seafood Show in Boston, coming up Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. U.S. intelligence officials are reviewing an audio tape allegedly made by Saddam Hussein. In the tape obtained by an Australian newspaper Monday, a voice purported to be that of Hussein calls on Iraqis to fight the foreign occupation of Iraq. The Middle East editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, Ed O'Loughlin, says he believes the tape is authentic.
We also have run an early but poor quality copy of the recording through voice analysts in Melbourne. And they came back yesterday with a figure of 70% to 80% probability that it is the voice of Saddam Hussein.
White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says there is no definitive proof of whether Hussein is alive or dead. The outgoing commander of the Army's 5th Corps says U.S. troops have evidence of an active Iraqi weapons program. Lieutenant General William Wallace has not provided details of the evidence, but says he's convinced Iraq had a program to make weapons of mass destruction. Wallace also says Iraq is still a dangerous place with criminal activity and shooting of small arms, still a problem. Authorities in Saudi Arabia say they've put a stop to plans by suspected terrorists to carry out attacks on the kingdom. The Saudi Interior Ministry says it seized a large cache of weapons and explosives today in the capital of Riyadh. At least 19 men are being sought in connection with the alleged plot. There's no word on what the alleged suspects were targeting. After nearly 10 months at sea, the USS Abraham Lincoln is home. The aircraft carrier has docked in Everett, Washington, following its long mission that included time in the Persian Gulf as part of the War on Terror. Vice President Dick Cheney says he'll be President Bush's running mate in next year's election. Cheney tells the Dallas Morning News that he's agreed to be on the ticket despite his heart troubles. Cheney has had 4 heart attacks, all of them before he became vice president. And more volatile weather is making its way through the Midwest today, just as residents are trying to recover from weekend tornadoes that killed 40 people. Tornadoes touched down in Louisiana and Arkansas this morning. Warnings were issued in Missouri, Tennessee, and Mississippi as well. On Wall Street at this hour, the market is narrowly mixed. The Dow is up 15 points at 8604. The Nasdaq is down 5 at 1519. And the S&P 500 is up a fraction. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Ah, the venerable pleasures of fishing, for the fisherman or woman, anyway. In the 17th century, Isaac Walton wrote in The Complete Angler that God never did make a more calm, quiet, innocent recreation than angling. But new research suggests that fishing may be less than calm, quiet, and innocent for the fish. With us to discuss her recently published study on what fish feel is Royal Society scientist Lynn Snedden. She's speaking to us from the University of Liverpool in Liverpool, England. Welcome, Dr. Snedden.
Thank you.
Dr. Snedden, you found that fish feel pain when they're hooked. Tell us about your study.
Well, the study really aimed to see whether the fish was capable of perceiving pain. And so, first of all, you have to show that the fish has the same nerves that humans and mammals do. So I looked at the anatomy of the fish's nerves, and these special nerves that only respond to painful stimuli were there. I recorded nerve impulses and found areas on the fish's face that only responded to painful stimuli and not to neutral stimuli. So these nerves were almost identical to those found in humans and mammals.
So fish's nerves feel pain. Why has no one ever figured this out before?
Well, the studies before have looked at sharks and skates and rays, and those are a different group of fish. They're cartilaginous fish. They don't have bony skeleton. And basically the studies on these cartilaginous fish failed to find these nerves. So it's always been suggested that no fish was capable of perceiving pain.
There was an American study that concluded that fish do not feel pain. Do you dispute that study?
Yeah, well, that review done by Rose at Colorado defined pain as having a special part of the brain called a neocortex. This means only humans and primates are capable of experiencing pain. So that means cats, dogs, deer, rats, mice, none of these animals can feel pain according to his definition. And there's been so many studies done on these animals to show that they do feel pain. I don't assume that pain's an emotional experience. I assume that it's a motivational state. And if the behavior of an animal is impaired during a painful event, then I think it's likely that the animal is in pain.
A motivational state?
Yeah.
Explain.
Well, motivational states are, you know, hunger, thirst, fear, pain, and they motivate the animal to do a certain task. For example, if it's hungry, it will go and find food. If it's thirsty, it will go, you know, to find water. And I think in pain, the animal is motivated to stop itself from being further injured or caused further pain.
Any reaction from anglers?
Yeah, I've had varied reactions. Some of them have condemned me for doing this study because I didn't use a hook as the pain-causing stimulus. It was bee venom and acetic acid, and they thought that was disgusting. But if they think it's disgusting, then they obviously agree that fish can suffer. And some anglers said that they accepted the results, but it wasn't going to stop them fishing.
Are you against fishing?
No, I'm not anti-angling. As long as people are catching the fish, getting them out quickly and killing them humanely and taking them home to eat, then I think there's a benefit to the human there in that they have some food. And I am a bit against catch and release, you know, constantly catching loads of different fish and throwing them back. I think there might be a welfare problem there.
Have you had any reaction from the fishing community, from people who may not feel they want to continue to fish?
No, I haven't spoken to anyone who's decided to give up fishing.
Dr. Lynn Snedden, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Lynn Snedden is a scientist with the Royal Society in London.
Well, fishermen also feel some pain when it comes to cod fishing. The cod, once so plentiful that an entire cape in Massachusetts bears its name, has been on the decline. And while it's making a slight comeback, it's not coming back quickly enough to avoid restrictions. In Newfoundland, where fishing has long been the mainstay of the economy, cod fishing has been temporarily banned, sparking outrage among fishermen and the province's leader, who vows to protect fishermen who break the new fishing law. In Massachusetts, fishermen say new restrictions slated for next year could bankrupt them. Well, joining us is Steve Murawski. He's a scientist at the National Marine Fisheries Service in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Good afternoon, Steve.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you, Rob?
Well, I'm fine, but let's start with the fact that the fish are making a slight comeback. So why is fishing being restricted and banned?
The critical issue is back in 1995, we understood that not only cod but all the other groundfish were declining at a very rapid rate. And so very restrictive regulations were put in place in terms of decreasing the number of days that fishermen could go to sea and also closing off large areas. And that's had some effect in terms of rebuilding some of the stocks. But based on our long-term estimates of the proper fishing rates, it seems that we have work to do, especially for the two cod stocks that exist off of the United States. Both of the stocks in the Gulf of Maine, which is defined as Cape Cod North, and the George's Bank area, which is offshore Massachusetts, plus the area to the south, have harvest rates on codfish that are above the long-term target levels.
What is the biggest problem? Is it that the fish, you know, don't have time to reproduce, or why do they keep declining?
Well, in the case of both of the cod stocks, we've at least stabilized them. But in the long term, overfishing reduces the reproductive capacity of the stock to the point where the new babies coming in the population can't balance out what's being taken out by fishing.
Why a total ban in Newfoundland and only a partial ban here?
The southernmost stocks are much more productive. And right now we feel that the two cod stock that we have control of are at about 20 to 30% of the long-term potential. Up north, the big stock off of Newfoundland is only about 3% of its long-term potential.
Mm. What do you say to the fishermen who are in pretty desperate straits?
Our projections are that we can make substantially more money out of healthy fish stocks that are restored to their long-term potential. We've seen actually a 40% increase in the amount of landings that have occurred since 1995 as some of the more productive stocks have bounced back quicker. Cod, unfortunately, has not bounced back as quick as some of the other stocks like haddock and yellowtail flounder. So in the long term, this will be good for the economy and good for the fishermen.
Yeah. But in the short term, it could hurt a lot of fishermen.
Well, there's no getting around. It's an issue of short-term pain versus long-term gain.
You know, when you go fishing, you're using nets. How do you avoid getting cod if you're going for something else?
Well, that's a difficult situation when we've got 19 different species stocks in a complex of species that we're trying to rehabilitate. And there's been very complex systems to push around the fishing effort in time and space to take advantage of the fact that at certain places and certain times the fish separate out more than they do at other times.
Well, Steve, you're here in New England. Other than the fact that the Cape is named after the fish and, you know, this is the home of the cod, what's the importance of keeping one fish?
These are all part of a very complex ecosystem, and fisheries are just one issue in a very large marine ecosystem. We have marine mammal issues, we have coastal issues, and in terms of the long-term prospects for the ecosystem, we need to make sure that fishery interests don't over-harvest to the point where we lose aspects of the biodiversity of the ecosystem as well as the productive capabilities.
Well, Steve, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Steve Murawski is with the National Marine Fisheries Services in Woods Hole, Massachusetts.
Well, still to come, beyond cod, we find an amazing array of fish at the International Seafood Show in Boston.
They're in pain, though. You're listening to Here and Now.
Music education is often one of the first programs to suffer the axe of school budget cuts. Recently, some folks at the MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts, along with musicians from the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, or BMOP, kept the spirit of music education alive by involving local kids in a unique music-making endeavor. Here and Now intern Lindsay Crudell visited a rehearsal of The Toy Symphony.
So I'm Todd Macover, and I'm a composer, professor at the MIT Media Lab, and I guess I'm the one who thought up this Toy Symphony project.
Where did it come from?
I also come from a background where my mom is a pianist and a really fantastic music teacher and a very creative music teacher, and my dad's actually a computer guy, so we had both those things in the family. When I had my two daughters, about 4 or 5 years ago when we started looking for music lessons, I looked for the kind of music teaching that my mom gave me when I was a kid, which was a combination of piano, but also a lot of really creative things, like we'd go and look for objects in the house that had interesting sounds, and a group of kids would come back together and say why the objects sounded interesting, how we could put them together, how we could make a piece out of them, and then how we could make pictures to remember the pieces. So remember, if you're doing the sounds and you lean to the mic, just remember, if the mic's here, just don't blow the wind right into the mic. You blow it on top of the mic. And when I looked around for my daughters, I realized that it's not very common, and most music teaching, especially for little kids, is not all that much fun and puts a fair amount of barriers in front of children. So my interest was to find a way to allow children to get into the center of music making, both performing and creating, as fast as possible, to get the bug, to fall in love with music, and then to ask for more.
Well, speaking of bugs, tell me a little bit about what makes up the symphony.
With my group at the MIT Media Lab, we invented a series of music instruments. We call them music toys for children, then developed a way of teaching music based on these, and then put children together with orchestras like BMOP to collaborate. And the main instruments for Toy Symphony are the beat bugs. These are handheld rhythm instruments. One of them is used to change the complexity of the rhythm. So if I tap something like dung tikka dung tikka dukka dukka dung, if I do one antenna, it goes dung tikka dung drink it dukka ta ta tikka dukka dukka. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Do it again? Oh, yeah, that's better. How about Julian? Good, good, good. Okay, Ruby, that's here. Much better.
And Paola? Oh, now we're talking. Yeah. Can you say at least one?
My name is Melina. I live in Brooklyn. I go to Lincoln School, and I'm in sixth grade. I'm 12 years old.
Has this changed the way that you listen to music?
I'm a 12-year-old girl, and I'm not really interested in classical and stuff like that. I like hip-hop and rap and all those kinds of things.
I'm Kaylin King, and I'm in 7th grade, and I'm 12. Well, also about the classical music kind of thing, it's just like, I mean, it makes you kind of interested in classical music because it's definitely putting a twist on it. It's cool.
Visit to MIT's Toy Symphony was produced by Here and Now intern Lindsay Cradell. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Fishmongers and people selling all sorts of fish-related gear docked recently at the International Seafood Show in Boston. We cast off Here and Now food guru Scott Haas to find some of the new ways the fruits of the sea are being prepared.
I'm inside the International Boston Seafood Show. This is the largest seafood and fish show in the entire United States. It's held once a year, and what I'm seeing are hundreds of different booths. Each of them is staffed by different companies, different countries, and they're here to show the world and to show us what are some of the most important things happening in seafood and fish today. To my right is a large lobster tank. These are Canadian lobster from Brunswick, Canada. And there's some crab. The wonderful thing about this kind of exhibit is everyone's eager to put forward their products. There's a fierce competition because there's only a limited amount of seafood and fish you can eat. So the question is, who's got the best?
That's very good.
I'm standing in front of Trident Seafoods, where I'm having an Alaskan salmon burger. It looks just like a hamburger, but it's salmon. Hi, I'm Scott Haas. I'm with Public Radio.
Scott.
And I just had this salmon burger, and it was great.
This is an Alaskan wild salmon product here. It happens to be a salmon burger.
So wait a minute. So one of the things that makes this so tasty, because I've had salmon burgers before, is that this is wild salmon.
Correct. So it's natural and omega-3.
It doesn't have that oily, fatty taste that you associate with farm-raised salmon. It's really, it's much denser tasting. It's more flavor. It was delicious.
It's a richer, cleaner flavor,
right.
I think. Yeah.
Right. Do you think that this is going to take the Golden Arches off the map, or what?
It would be nice to see someone like the Golden Arches or Burger King put a product like that on their menu. Absolutely.
Well, it's really healthy.
We've been aggressively selling it the last year, so.
Well, good luck. It was really delicious. Thanks for taking
thanks.
The time.
That's a shrimp avocado.
Now, this looks interesting. Morty the Knife Man. Now, why would a fellow be called Morty the Knife Man, and why would a knife man be at a fish fair? Let's find out. All of these, I suppose, are for working with fish. Those are oyster knives for shucking oysters. Are you Morty the Knife
yes.
Man?
Well,
it's a pleasure to meet you. Scott
Same
Hassel.
Here.
So tell me, if I'm a home cook and
yes.
I buy some fish and I were to have one knife in my kitchen.
Filet knife?
Yeah.
Like,
no.
Well, it depends what you want to do. Filet it, steak it, what do you want to do with it?
Well, let's say I go to the store and I buy a whole fish.
Yeah.
Then I'm
going
to take it home and
okay.
I'm...
Okay, first of all, are you going to filet it or eat it whole?
I'm going to eat it whole.
So then you got to scale it first with a scale.
Oh, we're talking with the scales on?
You want them to clean it for
That's
you.
That's right.
You want it scaled and gutted?
Correct.
Okay, then you're going to cook it whole.
Correct.
So now what do you want to know?
So what knife?
Then you don't need a knife.
The operator can both feel and see that the shrimp is in the correct position.
Oh, Tom Sherman, Director of Marketing for Icelandic USA at the Boston Seafood Show.
So, Tom, where are we standing? We're standing here at a booth, and in front of me there are these beautiful little, look like chicken nuggets, but they're not chicken nuggets because this is not a chicken fair, is it?
No, this is popcorn fish, and what's unique about it is that it's coated with the original buffalo sauce from the Anchor Bar in Buffalo, New York.
So these are buffalo wings, only they're buffalo fish.
They're buffalo fish. They're deep-skinned Alaska pollock. That's up for the new product of the year.
I'm going to taste one of these and tell you what I think, all right?
Okay.
Okay.
Go for it.
Delicious. Where's the game and the cold beer? Because that's what it feels like. It feels like it's going to be great with it, you know.
That's what it's designed to do.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, thank you very much for taking the time.
Absolutely. Thank you for stopping by.
Well, it seems that there's a big sign there with a beautiful little kitten. And it says, wow, looks really tasty. This is seafood for your pets. So, for example, your cat would be very happy with this. This is very fancy. This is a white and red meat tuna with prawns.
Animals eat better than humans.
That's what I'm thinking. Huh? That's exactly what I'm thinking.
How you doing?
Good. How are you? We're with Public Radio, and we're talking to different people here at the Seafood Fair.
Dudley Passman.
Dudley, tell me, how would you even pronounce the name of this?
It's a Zatarain's.
Zatarain's.
Right.
And it says New Orleans style. Jambalaya mix, gumbo base. What does it mean, New Orleans style?
We've been out of New Orleans since 1889. Very often, I got to say first, I think very often there's a misconception about New Orleans or food from Louisiana. People automatically assume it's going to be hot.
Right.
But we don't think, well, we may use a little more pepper, but at the same time, we'll use more pepper. We'll also use more onion and more garlic and more lemon, and we use more of everything. We think our food has more depth because we use different styles of seasoning, we use different amounts of seasoning, and the flavor should hit you at different places in your palate at different times. Would you like to try something?
I would love to try something. I'm allergic to shellfish, so don't kill me.
No, you're okay. This is a farm-raised catfish.
Uh-huh.
And this is using our crispy southern-style breading, which is a little bit coarse. It's called cream meal
or
corn
great.
Cones. You can see the different textures on the product there. The sauce I'd recommend to go with that would be our remoulade sauce.
Now, when you say remoulade sauce, what is
remoulade
that?
Remoulade is a classic French
okay.
sauce
uh-huh.
that is mayonnaise-based. It's almost, the French would hate for me to say this, but it's almost like a Thousand Island dressing,
uh-huh.
kind of that form.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Where our remoulade, New Orleans remoulade, is based more with Creole mustard.
Wow, this looks great. I'm going to try this. All right, thank you.
The fish just came out of the fryer, so it's very hot. Be careful.
It's hot.
Yeah,
not hot spicy, but hot.
No, hot with fire.
These are products that you can buy in the stores also. This is not.
Some you can. Some of our items go through direct grocery stores, so they're available. Our jambalaya mix, our dirty rice mix, our red beans and rice. Those are all available. Some of the other ones are a little more specialized, or really you can only find them on the food service side.
This is Handy Crab. It's a 100-year-old crab company that's synonymous with live soft-shell crabs and jumbo lump crab meat from the Maryland area. They are the name in Maryland crab product.
And Maryland is the home of soft-shell crab. The home of crab.
The home of crab. And over the last, 5 or 6 years, they've noticed a growing trend over the last 2 decades, which is that demand has outpaced supply of the soft-shell crab. So what they did was they found a phenomenal product that is from Thailand. It's a mangrove crab, and it also sheds its skin.
Oh.
And it's incredible. And those are what you're looking at in the pan over there. They're actually sized the same, but they're a little bit fatter, so they have a little more meat in them than the Maryland blue crab when it molts from its shell. But the exact same flavor, indistinguishable halfway around the world. And because of the aquaculture phenomenology over there, we're able to harvest the crabs 12 months out of the year because they don't have the same thaw, freeze, and sweat cycle that we do here.
So these are not
temperate zone.
These are not Maryland crabs.
These are not Maryland blue crabs.
Who found the crabs in the mangrove groves in Thailand? I mean, was somebody just walking around, they found these crabs and said, hey, let's bring them back to Maryland? I mean, that's, you know.
Terry?
Yes.
Do you want to step over here? The chairman of the company, and maybe he can answer that question.
I was going to say, who found the crabs in the mangrove groves? I mean, you know.
Fishermen.
Fishermen. And right. they called you up and they said, hey, Mr. Conway, you know, we've got these crabs? I mean.
No, I went and found them.
You went and found them. And somehow, how long have you been bringing them over? Are these from Thailand?
It's about 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
And it's been successful.
We bring them from Thailand, Miramar, and India.
What's most fabulous about it is that finally now people have a 12-month-a-year resource for them. And see, because everyone is very hesitant at first, oh, it can't be as good. And they are as good. They're excellent. They're the identical thing. So it's pretty exciting.
Well, they would have to be good. I mean, if you're bringing them to people in Maryland who know about crabs and they can say, well, this is the real thing, then it must be the real thing.
Well, I can fool any Marylander. Put them side by side and I can fool them all.
Well, that really is something. Well, listen, thank you very much for taking the time.
Okay. Sure. Thank you.
Well, after having been here for over an hour, I'm just grateful that I didn't eat anything that I died from.
Here now is food guru Scott Haas at this year's International Seafood Show in Boston.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wertlieb. Special thanks to Jordana Gustafson.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Strapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Lindsay Crudell, Marisa Francini, and Mekleka Samdani.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.